Os Guinness has written a pretty sobering chapter on the clock in our culture. It has been called the mother of machines, the tool that turned into a tyrant. If you've done any traveling in non-Western countries, you know that there's not just a difference in time zone, but a difference in the way people view time. For example, Filipinos have a saying, Westerners are people with gods on their wrists. And in Kenya, they say Westerners have watches but no time. Africans have time but no watches. Guinness points out there are three features of the modern clock time, three features that dominate the way modernity, modern people, view time and live in time. Number one is precision. He writes, "Naturally, we modern people take this precision for granted just as we take in the air we breathe. Ours is a world in which lawyers and psychiatrists charge by the hour. Telephone companies bill by the minute. Television networks charge advertisers by the second. Olympic athletes win or lose by hundredths of the second. And astronauts execute their life and death maneuvers in nanoseconds. Punctuality, Guinness goes on to write, has become a virtue in its own right and unpunctuality a vice. Second feature is coordination. And that is a synchronizing of various elements, what we could call polyphony. Polyphony is when you get two different, very diverse, for example, in music. Last week, we sang the song, You Are Holy. The women are singing one thing, the men are singing another thing. You've got diversity, but blended together into a unity. That's polyphony. Our lives are polyphonic. Maybe that's a new word. Good word. We try to synchronize, whether it's the airplane schedule with our schedule. We try to synchronize the traffic light with our car. We're constantly synchronizing diversity and unity. Guinness writes, much of the best and most basic in our lives pivots on timing. Getting up in the morning, meeting friends, keeping appointments, catching planes, fulfilling deadlines, expecting deliveries, watching the news, or arriving at the church on time. No ancient religious devotee could rival us modern people in our instant total obedience to the gods on our wrist that send us scurrying from one appointment to the next. So precision, and then secondly, coordination, and then thirdly, what's going to result from precision and coordination is pressure. Pressure would be the third major feature of modern clock era. We as a people are harried and hurried. Harried is not a name. It describes our lifestyle. Time is money, so we must maximize it. We must multitask so that we can use every minute possible. And even, it's ironic, I was thinking this week, as more and more people get split-screen TVs, even when we waste time, we want to do it in a timely manner so that we're still well aware of the time. Guinness says it is impossible to stop the world today, even if you want to get off. And this manic speed is affecting our faith as much as our blood pressure. And most of us can understand how it affects our blood pressure, but we may not totally understand how it affects our faith. And I want us to just look at one example as we consider the life of Abraham. There are more. But how does this view of time affect our faith? As I've been chewing over the timetable of Abraham, it seems to be quite clear that one of the areas where our faith is greatly affected by our Western modern view of time, which is a fairly new perspective, is that we assume that God's timing is the same as our timing. We assume that God views time as the same as we view time, because everybody views it the way we view it, right? That God's day timer is the same as our day timer. Chock full of things he's checking off throughout the day, knocking off the schedule so he can go to bed at night in peace. The life of Abraham is a beautiful, powerful description of or illustration of God's timetable. Because there's so much stuff about time, we cannot miss it. The end of chapter 16, You see, ends with a time statement, verse 16, Genesis 16, 16. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Chapter 17, verse 1, begins with a time statement. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him. So you've got, you know, and when you're going through the Bible in a year, you don't want to slow down between 16 and 17 or could mess up your checklist, right? So we just keep cruising along, but stop and think about what poor Abram just went through between 16 and 17. He's got a good 13 years of nothing. Nothing major happening. I mean, between 16 and 17. Now, sure, he got impatient in chapter 16 and tried to jumpstart the old minivan and get the family thing going. But as far as God's promise is concerned, nothing really happened. And when you stop and you put that in our language and our lifestyle today, imagine nothing happening in your life for 13 years. I mean, it's been a lot longer than that for Abram, but even since, that was since, 14 years was since he decided to do the Hagar thing. But during that period, the 13 years since Hagar had Ishmael and God appears to him in this chapter, nothing really has happened. And so I looked at my life. Okay, what was happening 13 or 14 years ago? And I was thinking, wait. Okay, North Hills didn't exist. I had none of my children. My wife and I were about to enter what humanly speaking you'd describe as one of the worst times of our lives. She was in going to the emergency room in the hospital, panic attacks. I mean, our marriage was struggling. I had no clue how to love my wife. Just a selfish, stubborn person. I was on staff at a church that was really struggling. A lot of unethical things happening. I mean, it's just a real time of God saying, hey, I've got some things for you to learn. And I started to think, okay, what if God left us there for 13 years to today? You know, my wife is still, let's say she was, she's not, she's, but let's say she's still in panic attacks every day, totally immobilized. I mean, this is not just being afraid. You've heard that testimony. Our marriage is still a mess, still waiting for kids. Have never seen, because I didn't grow up in a church, so I've never seen a good biblical church flourish. Let's say if nothing had happened over the next 13, 14 years, how would my faith be doing? Hello, God, are you there? Can you imagine Abram just waiting and waiting and waiting? The guy still had not seen one concrete fulfillment to God's promise. He was without a father. His father had died. He was without a son through Sarah. No son. He was without any land. He didn't own a piece of property, folks. Even when he buried his wife, he had to buy a cave. So the guy who's promised to be this great father of many nations and, you know, have all this land and be this big monarch of a guy is looking at his watch and saying, hello, God, are you doing anything? You know, is this a government project? Are we just going to meet and talk about it? You know, is anything actually going to begin? I just kept thinking this week as I was meditating on this when I work construction. You know how contractors do it? You know, when they tell you a certain date they're going to start, that they mean that's when they're going to deliver the wood. Don't expect to see anybody there actually working. You know, we would just deliver the wood. Oh, yeah, something's happening. There's wood out there. You know, and then a few weeks later, some grunt like me would show up, kind of move the wood around, you know, break the metal bands on the wood, and wow, they're working out there. There's a building going up. No, they're just moving wood now. And that's, Abram must have felt like that. You know, what is happening here? It's been 24 years since God said, leave your family, I'm going to make you a big family. So for a quarter of a century, there's nothing happening. I can't imagine. I mean, that culture was different, had a different view of time. I mean, Abram didn't have a Palm Pilot, I assume. And so his daytimer was a little freer than our daytimer. I would be freaking out. And God comes to him and says to him, chapter 17, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Now here's the nomad, probably the mad nomad, who's saying, I believe we've covered this ground before. You know, the making covenant and the multiplying you exceedingly stuff. You know, are we gonna keep going over this? But I love Abram's response, and this just amazes me. Verse 3, Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. You know, if there's anything Abram learned in 24 years, he may not know the timetable of God, he may not have all the answers to life's mysteries, but he sure knows who's in charge and who isn't in charge. Whew, if we can just get that down. I am Almighty God. That is the word El Shaddai. God says, I am El Shaddai. God doesn't appear to be in much of a hurry here, does he? You know, he just shows up after 13 years of just lumber sitting there, and he says, I'm Almighty God. That word El Shaddai, as Matt alluded to, is a tough word for linguists to figure out what the root is. Some people say the root comes from a word that forms into a mountain, which would symbolize God's strength. God is strong. He is powerful. And that's communicated in that word. And other people would come, other linguists have argued that it comes from the word breasted, which would have the idea of provider, as a mother provides for her children. God is sufficient. God is satisfying. Probably the best way to figure out the meaning of this word is not to go from its root, but to go from its use. If we look at its use, you'll see it is used consistently contrasting human inability with divine ability. El Shaddai shows up when men are unable, women are unable, and he proves that he is able. Or you could summarize it this way: God provides by his power when we can't. El Shaddai, the powerful provider, in contrast to we who are unable and can't. And he says, very simply, almost matter-of-factly, without any explanation as to the time gap, walk before me. Walk before me. Don't run, don't skip, don't crawl. Walk before me. Now, what does that mean? I've been chewing on this a lot lately because I don't think we really understand that term. I mean, you don't walk up to your kids and say, hey, kids, walk before me. Probably an illustration that has helped me understand this is just thinking through conversations I've had with men, for example, who struggle with losing their temper. Men may at times come, let's say you come home from work and your kids are driving you crazy, or you're on a trip. This holiday season, if you go on a trip, this will be a great chance to live this out. You know, your kids are bouncing around the back, yelling and screaming, and all of a sudden it's just push your button too far. And dad is ticked. And so he lets them have it verbally. Or starts yelling or screaming or throwing things or something. And if you sit down with dad and you talk to him and you say, Dad, you know, what's going on here? He says, I can't help it. I mean, these kids drive me crazy. My wife knows my buttons, and man, she will push them. It's like she wants me to get mad. I can't help it. I've talked to some dads in that struggle, and I've asked them this question. Have you ever lost it on your boss? You know, I mean, really let your boss have it. Cussed him out, yelled, screamed through things. How about that customer? You know, that client you're trying to make that big deal with, and you're just about to go through, and he shows up for the appointment late. What did you do? Did you lose it? No. You can't do that Why? Well, they're a client, they're a customer. So what? Well, you'll lose money. Ding, 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 ding. You see, we have selective temper losing. You know, we can control our temper when it's really important to us. We can lose it when it's not. I mean, she's just my wife. They're just my kids. They've got to stay here. They can't fire me. You say, what does that have to do with walking before? Because that man, me, you, when we do that, when we live that way, what we are revealing is we walk before something. We don't walk before our wife or our husband or our kids. We walk, what motivates our daily walk, our daily decisions reveal what we're really living for, what the context of our life is really driven by. And in that case, it is money, right? Or advance. I mean, when money's on the line, I can control my temper. When advancement is on the line, I can be a saint. Suddenly have this newfound internal power of discipline. Do you see that reveals what I walk before? And what God is saying to Abram is, what if you were to walk before me? So that what controls your thoughts and your decisions and your responses is me. What dominates your lifestyle and the timing of your lifestyle and what's supposed to happen next is me. El Shaddai. What a transformation that brings about on us, because it's not just I'm one thing with one person and another thing with another person. I mean, because God is everywhere. Walk before me. Walk before me. Walk before me. And be blameless, it goes on to say. Yo, how do we do that? Well, the word blameless isn't communicating sinlessness as much as it is communicating a wholeness. That's what that word means. A completeness. An integrity. Not half-hearted, fickle devotion, but a wholeness, a wholeheartedness. Walk before me and be wholehearted about it. Don't give part way. Don't be fickle today, tomorrow kind of thing. Give and take, come and go. No, be wholehearted. Be blameless. Well, as I've been chewing over this, how do you really walk before God in a wholehearted manner? I heard recently somebody wrestling through from a different perspective from Psalm 16, and I was chewing over on that, and my kids and I tried to bring it down to where we could really understand it. Psalm 16:8 says, David says, I have set the Lord always before me. You see that? That's a deliberate decision of David to say, I have set the Lord always before me. And it's not talking before me like putting God on a mantle. He's talking about before me in the sense of he's right here. And again, we had trouble trying to understand what does that mean, so we drew some pictures. First of all, this is me looking through what typically is before me. What is typically right before me? It's the fact that something's not happening quick enough. I'm not getting my checklist done fast enough. Things are not moving. I mean, the timing of things, or the trials, or the temptation that I'm facing. These are the things, or the mundane things of life. These are the things that are right before me. And so we start seeing God through these things. You know, he's faithful if everything works out the way I want it to work out. He's right on top of it if the timing is as I anticipated, or if the temptation's not as hard as I had hoped or feared. So we see God through life circumstances. And David is recommending, he's affirming in his heart, he's saying, no. You need to change that. Set the Lord before you. So we do a different picture, and that is, this is the way it's supposed to be. Rather than things wedging themselves in between God and me, I have set God before me. So I see all of life's circumstances, his timing for my life, the trials that I go through, the mundane things of life, the temptations all get sifted through who God is. El Shaddai, the provider, the powerful one. You see how that changes everything when people come to you and they say, hey, you got to praise God regardless of your circumstances. If you're looking at God through those, you can't barely see him. On Sunday, he seems big and real, maybe. But throughout the week, he seems really puny. Why? Because you're looking at God through everything. David is saying, no, I've set the Lord before me in the sense of right there. So everything I see is being seen through who he is, his character, his power, his plan, his word. And it changes everything. It totally changes the way I view life's circumstances, good and bad. And that is a difficult process. Because the minute I start going through my daily life, we were talking about, as my kids and I, as all these examples of things that try to wedge themselves in between, try to squish their way so that they are viewed as dominant versus who God is and what he's doing in my life. And God comes to Abram in the middle of his time of waiting and says, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be wholehearted. Be blameless in the sense of don't let anything wedge itself in between. Don't be partial. Don't be fickle. Circumstances are going to change. I will not. And the reason he says we can be wholeheartedly devoted to him is in verse 2. He is wholeheartedly devoted to us, as he confirms to Abram. He says in verse 2, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. I will make my covenant between me and you. That word make could be translated give. It's the idea of God is the one who's initiated this covenant. It's a grace gift, Abram. You couldn't produce it. If you try to set up, if you see his command to walk before me and to be blameless as a challenge or as a law, then you're not going to make it. He's coming to you saying, this is what I want to give you. I'm giving you myself. I'm giving you my covenant. And that phrase, my covenant, is used 9 times in this chapter. It's God's covenant. He is a covenant-keeping God. Over and over again, we see that. Well, look at Abram's response. I mean, he fell to his face. He fell on his face. He responded in humility and awe. People, don't ever forget that although James 2 describes Abram as the friend of God, his friendship grew out of his awe of God. Some of us lose that. You know what? We want to be intimate with God, but we have no fear of God. And so you're intimate with the construction of your own mind. I mean, he's not the living, awesome God, El Shaddai. He's this puppet that you want to use for your own benefit. There's no real friendship with that God because he doesn't exist. And in our culture, we really struggle with that, don't we? Because people want an intimate God, but they don't know the living God, the El Shaddai. You can't put him in your little box and pull him out when you need him. Well, God turned to Abram, and I love this. It says, God talked with him. God talked with him. God had a chat with Abram. Pull up a stump, Abram, because in verse that you can divide this chapter into 3 parts. Verse 4, God says, as for me. If you underline, you may want to underline that phrase. As for me. This is my part. Verse 9, God says to Abraham, as for you. Verse 15, God said to Abraham, as for Sarah. As for Sarah. So, as for me, this is my promise. This is my promise that I want to make with you, Abram. Let's read verses 4 through 8. As for me, behold, my covenant is with you. You shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, which means exalted father. But your name shall be Abraham, which means father of a multitude or father of many nations. For I've made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. And I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant. That's God's timetable. 3 times he says that in this chapter. Everlasting covenant. To be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. What a promise. There's a biological fulfillment, and there's a spiritual fulfillment. The biological fulfillment is seen, as we'll see at the end of chapter 25, there are kings that literally came out of Abraham. We see that biological fulfillment again. Well, first of all, you've got Abraham. 1,000 years later, what king shows up? King David. The whole Davidic dynasty. 1,000 years after that, who shows up? Jesus. And Matthew 1 begins, and this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. God kept his promise. But people, don't forget, we're talking 1,000 years between Abraham and David, and then between David and Jesus. God's timetable is not the same as our timetable. We must never forget that. That's why our hurried and harried lifestyle affects more than our blood pressure. It challenges our faith in what God says and whether he's going to keep his promise. God literally kept his promise to make kings out of Abraham. But there's also a spiritual fulfillment to that, that the New Testament emphasizes. In Romans 4, it's up on the screen, therefore it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, which are the Jews, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. See how he's quoting from Genesis here? In the presence of him whom he believed, God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did. That's El Shaddai. He is the only one who can call things that don't exist as though they did, because he's the only one who has the power to bring about things that don't exist yet and know they're going to happen. He is powerful. He is the provider. When man comes to a place where they realize there's no way I can bring this out, that's why the scriptures emphasize he gives life to the dead. I mean, Abram and Sarah, as we'll see in a second, were feeling pretty dead as far as producing family. Their systems were shutting down in the family department. And yet God is saying, that's exactly the time where I want to do what only I can do. So don't lose hope. El Shaddai. As for me, this is my promise. It's an everlasting promise. Verse 9, as for you, this is Abram's role. God said to Abram, as for you, you shall keep my covenant. You and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. And he who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generations. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant, he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money must be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. Well, first of all, we have to understand, because God has come to Abram a number of times. He came in chapter 12, came in chapter 15, he confirms his covenant again here in chapter 17. While God gives his covenant freely, he calls Abram to confirm that covenant obediently. The covenant is given by grace, but he is calling Abram here to obediently live out that covenant. What is the core of the covenant? What is the core of the covenant here? the whole section is so strong about what is the essence of this covenant. And you'll see it in verse 7 in the past there. I will establish my covenant between me and you, your descendants after you, and their generations for an everlasting covenant. What is that covenant? To be God to you and your descendants after you. So the covenant is that of commitment or relationship, ownership. God is saying, you are mine. I am yours. We're going to have a relationship that will last forever. That is the essence of the covenant. Don't miss that. That's the core of the covenant, is I want to have a relationship with you. And the most amazing thing of this section where God says, Abram, this is your role, is there's no lists of commandments. You notice that? I mean, that's living out that covenant is going to become more clear in the Mosaic law as God lists out some of those regulations. But as God establishes that covenant, his primary focus is the essence of this covenant is a relationship between God and his people. That cannot be produced by a list of commandments. So what is the sign of the covenant? Well, that's the point he makes in verses 9 through 14. And what is that? Circumcision. I got to warn you, folks. Tonight, you're going to hear the first ever Christmas circumcision message. You excited about that? So if you could invite your neighbors and friends and dress in your Christmas colors and tell them we've got this special Christmas program, but people aren't going to be up in a tree singing, we're going to hear about circumcision. Some of you may say, why are you doing that to us? Well, I want to explain a couple reasons. One is, I really want to finish chapter 17 because next week and the week after, Mike Kwok, before he goes back to Australia, is going to do a two-part series on the Christian and suffering. And those of you, Mike's wife went to be with the Lord recently. They walked through that whole journey of cancer and now raising three kids on his own. He has walked through that journey and really, in soaking in the Word, has a message for us to hear. And before he goes back to Australia, I really want us to hear that. So that I wanted to finish chapter 17 before then and not start a different Christmas series in between. But the second reason is I did not realize until recently how controversial this whole subject is. Did you know that? This is a really hotly debated issue today. That if you get on, you can debate on the web, you can read books about it that are pretty intense. And I think there's a lot of confusion out there. So tonight, I think we're going to be able to make a transition, from Christmas to circumcision. It's going to be a little bit of a leap, but if you come ready to hang in with me, we'll be able to make it. And if you do feel uncomfortable with this subject, we are going to have a breakout session for the kids. So seriously, there will be something for your kids to go to if you would like them to go to that, especially the younger kids that you really don't want to teach them how to spell the word, nevertheless what it means at this point. So tonight, I will go into this subject in a little more detail. But as for me, verse 4, as for you, verse 9, and then in verse 15, he turns to Sarah and says, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. Now, both words, if you have a study Bible, you'll notice both words basically mean the same thing. They mean princess. And it's like God is saying to Abraham, she was your princess, and she still is your princess. Why is that so significant? Because when princesses have children, what do they become? Especially when they have sons. They become kings. So although Abram, I know you've kind of gone off the plan here and slept with Hagar and tried to make your own, line there because you grew impatient, but my plan hasn't changed. Sarah is still the one who is to be, as he goes on to describe, verse 16, and I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. So although your plan has changed a bunch of times, Abram, my plan has not. Wait on me. I'm going to do this. Well, this was obviously a little confusing to Abram, because in verse 17, he fell on his face. That would hurt. That's an Old Testament expression. And laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Are you serious? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a son, a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. God, can't we kind of just go the easy route? We got a guy here. No, he's a good guy. Let's just go with him. Why do we have to, I can't even imagine the thought. 100-year-old man. And his poor wife. It's not time, you know, to start working in the nursery again. I mean, she's done. And God says, no. Sarah, your wife. You notice how he emphasizes that? Your wife. Hagar's not your wife. Sarah, your wife. Your princess shall bear you a son and shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. So he's not just blowing Ishmael out the door. I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. Woohoo! We finally have a timetable. I mean, even in his laughter, Abram must have been like, can I count on that? Like, are we talking next year? Not any of this 1 year is like 1,000 kind of thing, but are we talking next year? I'm gonna write this down, call the local roaming doctor. Next year. Whew. Then he finished talking with him and God went up from Abraham. What an amazing conversation, isn't that? The Almighty God came to the mad nomad and said, as for me, this is who I am, and this is what I can do. This is what I'm going to do. As for you, you be committed. You are mine, I am yours. And I'm going to give you a seal, a sign of that ownership. Circumcision didn't produce the relationship, it confirmed it. As for Sarah, my plans for her are not done. Humanly, it's impossible, yes. But what is humanly impossible, El Shaddai loves to do. You're going to have a son next year. Now, your job, Abram, is to do what? Walk before me. Wholeheartedly, blamelessly, walk before me. Now, again, that's still way up here, isn't it? What does that mean? I'll tell you, this time of year, I really struggle with that most in the mundane things. How do you walk before God and go to the mall? Now, I've worked it out to where when you go to Home Depot, I can still walk before God. But if going to Home Depot is like a little picture of going to heaven, going to the mall is like a picture of the other place. So how do you walk before God when you're shopping, when you're studying, when you're working and building and just living? How do you walk before? I was just crying out to God, driving to a store, which is, you know, the ultimate sacrifice for any husband. I'm driving to the store thinking, God, how do I walk before you? Because if seeing you as El Shaddai is coming to a life-transforming awareness that you are able and I am not, then if I'm going to walk before you, then all day, every day, day in, day out, minute by minute, I should be dominated by the thought that I am not able, but you are able. But then when you boil that down, you realize, well, God, I mean, that's not really true. Right? I mean, yeah, I know he has to give me breath to live every second. But I can teach myself to change the oil in my car without a keen awareness of God's presence. You know? I can go to the mall and knock off my checklist without walking before you wholeheartedly. You know, I can even teach myself to preach a sermon without walking before you. I can come week after week and I can sing. You know, I can just stand there and sing. And words can come out. And there could even be an ounce of sincerity in there. And I may not be walking before you at all. So what is he saying? Well, you know, Abram could do the same thing, right? He could go to Egypt and get help. He could sleep with Hagar and get a kid. But God was saying, that's not what I'm calling you to. I'm not calling you to just check your list off. I'm not calling you to just get it done. I'm not just calling you to live your life and knock off the errands so that you can say at the end of the day, my day timer is finished. I'm calling you to enter into a totally different way of living and thinking. That El Shaddai, the Almighty God, wants to change me in such a way that as I go through those daily routines and do some of those mundane things that I have to do, whether it's having kids or changing diapers or doing my job or shopping or whatever it is, I'm doing those things before the living God, and he is transforming those activities from being just mundane checklists to, look at you work. Look what you're doing. Okay, you say, well, still, how do you do that? Well, as I'm driving to the store, I'm thinking, okay, God, can I go to the store? Well, I'm able to go to the store. I can, you know, start the car and drive there. But what if I'm walking before you? I'm saying, okay, as the frustrating traffic or people or things or inaccessibility of whatever you need come my way, Lord, I want to walk before you. It's going to give me a totally different attitude about those things, right? It's not just about checking off the list, being harried and hurried. As people come my way who look kind of gross or get in my way, or keep me from knocking off my list, if I'm walking before you, all of a sudden, those are divine appointments. This isn't just about knocking off my timetable. This is about, God, what are you up to? What are you doing in me, through me? That your plan is very different. Your plan is not just to get Abraham to have a kid. He could do that. Your plan is to produce children of promise, to do the miraculous. Can you imagine if we unleashed on this community, this group of people who are walking before God at the mall, who are walking before God at their work site? God, I know I can go to work today and get my job done and make my boss happy and come home and put food on the table. And if that's life, I can knock it out. But I know that you sent your son to die for me, not because I can do it, but because I can't. If do it means live like everybody else and knock off your checklist, then sure, Jesus didn't need to die. Just go through it, live today, and tomorrow you die, and it's all over, and spend eternity regretting it. But if living means, it's what Jesus talked about in Abundant Life, walking in the presence of God, aware that my timetable is not the same as his and that my ability is totally inadequate. I don't want to just get through a sermon and say, that's done. I don't want to just check off another list. I don't want to just get to the another day and say, wow, God, glad that's over with. Can't wait till Friday night. Harried and hurried and maximizing every moment for what purpose? Walk before me. Don't let those things wedge themselves in between you and him. And every drive becomes a time of worship. You know, and every purchase becomes an act of gratefulness. God, thank you that I can buy this for them. That was a gift from you. And every interaction becomes an opportunity to encourage or to share Christ. And even those family get-togethers around Christmas and New Year's that you're so uncomfortable about, God, I can go there and sit and watch football and just leave and do the normal thing and everything's cool. Or, God, I am unable to live you before my family. I am unable, God. I'm acknowledging that now. I'm going to acknowledge it every 5 minutes, but I'm excited about what you can do through me. And I don't know what that's going to be. I mean, every interaction is a new adventure. I don't know what people in my family are going through, but I'm sick and tired of just the superficial football talk or cooking talk. I want to find out what you're doing in so-and-so's life for the first time. I want to learn how to ask the kind of questions that really get beyond the superficial. I want to show love and not just be there for myself. Wow, that's like walking before God on vacation. And that's what God has called us to.